Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're airing a different interview today on The Morning Show. We hope to bring you cartoonist Joe Martin another day. Nowadays, of course, NFL football is front and center in American cultural life, popular life. And it is important for us to remember that once upon a time, it was not so. Professional football was not nearly so central in American pastime and focus. That really changed most dramatically 50 years ago when an extraordinary game was played, which many people call the most exciting football game ever played. And certainly it can be said that it is the single most important, influential football game ever played. We're talking about the NFL Championship game of 1958 between the Baltimore Colts and the New York Giants. And this game, which was nationally telecast, really helped propel professional football into another sphere and helped lead to the creation of a rival league, the AFL, and which eventually, of course, merged with the NFL into the present-day league and propelled football into a whole different realm of popularity. And a book has been written which examines not only this game specifically and in very interesting detail, but also gives us some context of where professional football was and where it was about to go. The book is The Best Game Ever, Giants vs. Colts, 1958, and the Birth of the Modern NFL. And it is by the wonderful writer Mark Bowden. And we have spoken to Mark Bowden on several different occasions on this program. He's probably best known for his book Black Hawk Down, but has written some very interesting books as well, including Guests of the Ayatollah, which talks about the Iran hostage crisis. We spoke to him about that. Finders Keepers, a wonderful true life story of a man in Philadelphia who finds an immense amount of money, and all kinds of other things. Mark Bowden writes so effectively on a wide range of topics and issues. This book is published by Atlantic Monthly Press, and again, it's called The Best Game Ever. And Mark Bowden, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much.
I wonder, ahead of you beginning work on this, how much did you know about this game? And what in particular drew you to it as the subject for a new book?
Well, I knew of the game. It obviously is one of the most famous in NFL history. And I grew up the latter part of my childhood in Baltimore, so I knew this team. And, of course, I heard a lot about this game. I was a little too young to have seen it myself. So I was always interested in it. The idea of writing this book was actually proposed to me by my publisher, Morgan Entrekin, several years ago after I had finished writing Guests of the Ayatollah. He knew that I was a football fan. I'd written a book some years ago about the Philadelphia Eagles in 1992 called Bringing the Heat. I was a football writer for a brief period in my experience as a newspaper reporter. So this was an opportunity to return both to a subject matter that interested me and also a piece of my own past.
Hmm. It's intriguing to write about something which is 50 years in the past, unlike, for instance, Guests of the Ayatollah, the Iranian hostage crisis, which is about half as many years in our past as this football game. As you sought to connect with some of the principal players, I'm using that term in a couple of different ways, of course, who were part of this game, it had to be frustrating to know that some of them were already gone.
It's true. You know, I think roughly half of the men who played in this game are still around, and I was able to track down most of them. I was frankly surprised and delighted that so many of them were still around, and they were, you know, extremely helpful. But it is true that my work does seem to be regressing deeper and deeper into the past. And as you move further back into the past, obviously you, by necessity, have to rely more and more on documentary evidence and the record. So I get a great deal of pleasure out of researching old newspaper files and looking for artifacts like, say, the audio recording of the NBC broadcast of this football game. And it's really, it's a little bit like a treasure hunt. You go off in search of documentation for the thing that you're going to write about, and every once in a while you really strike gold.
Hmm. I think I've touched on the fact that this game was nationally telecast, but you tell us, or at least imply, that absolutely nothing of this game survives in terms of any footage from that telecast.
That's right. There's no footage of the actual television broadcast, but there are a smattering of films of the game. NFL Films made a documentary 25 years ago about this game, which has some really terrific black and white footage shot on the sidelines. It was not from the television broadcast. It was from someone operating a camera on the sidelines, even though NFL Films didn't exist in 1958. And then there was, of course, what's called the coaches film, which is NFL teams all utilize film to study their opponents and to prepare for their next football game. And so this game, like every game, was filmed from a vantage point high over the 50-yard line, where you can see all of the players on the field, virtually the entire field. It's very useful for study purposes. It's nothing at all like or nearly as exciting as the footage that you watch on a television broadcast. But for coaches who are looking to study plays and formations and strategy, the coach's film is actually a more useful tool.
So how much of this game exists on film? I mean, even if it is from a kind of a distant, frustrating vantage point, as you just described, I mean, do we have all or nearly all or a substantial portion of this game on film?
The entire game is on film.
Really?
And I was very fortunate to recruit the help of Philadelphia Eagles head coach Andy Reid, who, out of the goodness of his heart and out of his own curiosity, sat with me for hours dissecting that coach's film, which is, of course, what he does for a living. And his insights into the strategies of the teams, the formations, the abilities of the players was invaluable to me and really informed my analysis of the whole game in the book.
You mentioned the fact that the radio broadcast, I think you said, over NBC also exists. And indeed, that broadcast is quoted throughout the course of your book, including once in a while interesting mistakes, as sometimes occur in live broadcast.
That's right. You know, I used the radio broadcast to try to capture some of the excitement and immediacy of the game. We're all used to watching football games with commentary. It's just part of the experience. And so to have that instant explanation and reaction on a recording was invaluable to me, I think, in trying to capture the atmosphere. And yes, that does occasionally come with the mistakes that broadcasters make, having to unravel a complicated, fast-moving game very quickly.
I wanted to mention one other thing that you mentioned very much in passing in the introduction. You called this game between the Giants in their dark blue helmets and the single red stripe and blue wool jersey and the white numbers, and the Baltimore Colts with the horseshoe emblem on their white helmets and badly soiled whites with blue numbers and trim. You called this a colorful spectacle for those present, but for the far bigger part of its audience, the most celebrated game in football history would be remembered primarily in black and white. And I think that's so interesting, because even if all we've ever seen are still photos of this game, I've only seen photographs of this game in black and white. And it never really stopped. I never stopped to think about how I only think of this in black and white. And
right.
It's interesting how that changes our view of it and in some ways even heightens our sense of the drama that played out that day stretching into the evening.
It's true, and there's a reason why Hollywood filmmakers really enjoyed and exploited the shadows and light in sort of the monochrome of black and white film to make these wonderful film noir classics. And it isn't just the fact that this game was seen primarily in black and white, because black and white was the only kind of televisions around in 1958 for the most part, but the fact that the game was played late in the afternoon and spilled over into the evening, into night, and the lighting in Yankee Stadium, where night games were not as common as they are today, was not as effective as it is. If you go to a night game, football or baseball today, the whole arena is illuminated like it's noon. But back in 1958, the lights were very adequate for lighting up the field, but they didn't light up the stands. And so what that meant when you looked at this black and white picture on your television was you had a brightly illuminated field of play and a stark black backdrop, as though someone had just lowered a black curtain, which I think made the action appear all that more dramatic and memorable.
You say many of the viewers, meaning now the viewers of the telecast, just beginning to tune in, were not regular watchers of pro football, and they were seeing something starkly different than the traditional college games played on sunny autumn afternoons. This was more like mortal combat from some dark underworld. As in some medieval rite, the players on both sidelines were draped in long capes. A master cinematographer could not have lit the scene more dramatically. We're speaking with Mark Bowden about his wonderful book called The Best Game Ever, which is a look at the NFL championship game of 1958. Just ahead of us talking specifically about the game, I want to return to the matter of your encounters with many of the principal players involved in this game, literally some of the players on the field and also others who were important participants. You tell us at one point in the book that one of the most extraordinary things about this game is that when you consider the players on the field and the coaches on the sideline and how many future members of the NFL Hall of Fame were on the field or in that stadium, it truly is a constellation of incredible greatness playing out here.
It's true. There were 17 future members of the Hall of Fame, and it was certainly the greatest assembly of talent ever in a professional football game. And what's more interesting about it, even just than the fact that all these great players and coaches and owners were there, but that the reason that so many of these players and coaches went on to the Hall of Fame is that they were really at the vanguard of the evolution of the game of pro football. So, for instance, you had as the two assistant coaches for the New York Giants, Vince Lombardi on the offense and Tom Landry coaching the defense. Well, they were young coaches then. They had yet to develop their own style. And, of course, Lombardi went off to Green Bay and created the great dynasty of the Green Bay Packers. And Landry went off to Dallas to create his own dynasty there. The reason that they went on to such heights is that they were innovators who were stretching the strategies and tactics of football in new directions. And, you know, the success that they would have later on is just testament to how innovative they were. And a lot of those the budding approaches that they were taking are visible in this game.
You mentioned the fact that about half of these players are still alive, and many of them you were able to speak to. And that's, of course, one of the things that enriches this book immeasurably. I wonder, sometimes as people look back on events from 50 years before, the memories are clouded, or perhaps they see things very much from their own perspective and not that of others. Can you give us any general reaction to the experience of speaking with these men about this big day from so much earlier in their lives, the clarity of their recollection, and maybe the wisdom with which they were able to look at these events now?
You know, it varied greatly, and it's really interesting to see how. I mean, on the one hand, on one extreme, you had Raymond Berry, who is a very cerebral, was a very cerebral football player and coach, and who's someone who kept meticulous notes, which he prepared actually before the game, and has sort of made a study of football all of his life. He remembers this football game from 50 years ago as though he played it yesterday. And he has the advantage of all of his notes to jog his memory. On the other extreme, you have a wonderful character like Fatso, Artie Donovan, who has been dining out on his wit and his humorous anecdotes about his days as a pro football player for a half century. And his memories of this game are rich and colorful, but are not always exactly true. You want to tell Artie's stories the way he tells them, though, just because they're so artfully and comically prepared. But you have to go back to the record to make sure that Artie remembers things exactly. Some guys, like Ordell Bracy, a really bright guy, has nevertheless misremembered certain key aspects of the game and has no doubt remembered them incorrectly for so long now that they are just, you know, they've become his memory. But the film of the game and the radio broadcast contradict him in certain key areas. So it is really interesting.
You, of course, were too late to be speaking directly to, for instance, the Colts quarterback, Johnny Unitas, who passed away several years ago. And, of course, there are a number of players who are now gone. But, of course, you also had a rich legacy of all the interviews which many of these important players did.
Right.
And over again, of course, this would be a game they would be asked about repeatedly.
Yep. And it's almost always the case when I write a book or a story about something that includes, you know, certain very famous people. If I can't have access to those people, either because they refuse to be interviewed or they've deceased, generally they're the least significant people for me to not be able to meet personally, because, as you say, they've been interviewed so many times in the past. So Johnny Unitas's recollections of this game have been written about and analyzed and pored over for a half century, whereas somebody like Al Berry, who played offensive line for the New York Giants, I doubt that, you know, more than two or three people have ever interviewed Al at any length about his memories of the game. So he was more valuable, frankly, to me.
One person that I wish you had come along soon enough to interview would be Alan Ameche. And I say that because for the many listeners to this program who are from Kenosha, Wisconsin, they would have, of course, dearly loved to have heard even more about this great running back. Of course, you talk about him in the pages of your book, and he is one very colorful character indeed in this drama.
Mm-hmm. Well, he is, and he, you know, a great lover of opera, which was a sort of an unusual taste for a football player. A really bright guy who, in addition to his athletic ability, proved to be an extraordinarily astute businessman and investor who made millions when he left football. I think one of the revelations in this book about Alan Ameche, which I've never seen reported anywhere else, is how disgruntled he was playing for Weeb Eubank, his head coach. Eubank, who used a method of motivation for some players who he didn't particularly like, which he called needling, began needling poor Alan Ameche right after he joined the football team. And Ameche cut his career fairly short. He only played for 6 years, even though he was a tremendous success in pro football. And a lot of people have wondered why he bowed out quite so early. And one of the reasons was that he did not like playing for Weeb Eubank. And, of course, at the time, it wasn't very easy for players to change teams.
Let's talk about 1958. And what made this such an important time for the game of football? You say in 1958, professional football, the league and its audience were on the cusp of an explosion. Tell us the state of affairs leading up to 1958. What was professional football like in this era, and how was it perceived? So we can better understand then the catalyst of change that this game in 1958 proved to be.
Well, of course, pro football had been around for about 30 years and had been growing in popularity throughout the 20th century. It was really the advent of television and the sort of merger of television and football, which occurred most dramatically in this game, that launched pro football. But basically, prior to the sort of the boom years of the 1950s, baseball was the only really major sport in America. It was the national pastime, and it really dominated the leisure time and interests of the American people. But as the wealth of our society grew and people had more and more leisure time, there was a great deal of interest, growing interest in sports as both a recreational activity and as something to watch. And this, of course, this growth in leisure time and interest in sports was happening at the same time that television was maturing and every household in America was getting a television set. So what was about to happen was the sort of explosion, not just of football, but of really sports in general. I mean, you have the creation of professional hockey leagues and basketball, and of course today, you know, there's many more sports that occupy America's interest. Of all these, football is the most successful and is the one that has best exploited television. And I think it's because, you know, football is an ideal sport for a television broadcast.
I would like you to explain that just a little bit further. You talk about the game's inherent appeal and what you call its neat fit with TV, and that you put those two things together and pro football and the public were just bound to fall in love with one another. And, of course, 1958 is the moment that happens. Just explain for a moment why football is such a perfect fit with television. What is it exactly about the game?
Well, George Will sort of famously and disparagingly described football as combining two of the worst aspects of American culture, violence and punctuated by committee meetings. And that is true. But the reason that those things are so popular in America is because they're fascinating. You know, football game takes place on a big field, but before every play, all of the players huddle. They decide what they're going to do next, which builds suspense. And then they all line up in a very compact formation, which fits fairly neatly within the binds of a television set. And on the snap of the ball, they execute this play, which takes place over, you know, rapidly, very fast. There are a lot of players, and 22 players in motion. And frankly, it's pretty difficult for someone sitting in the stands of a football game to fully understand what has just happened on any given play. With football, because there's this delay between plays, it gives television nowadays, especially with the tools of slow motion replay and isolated cameras, and of course the commentary of expert football watchers, in the period between plays, you know, we basically what happens is television sorts out the action for us. It isolates the key players. Sometimes nowadays, the analysts will actually draw up on a telestrator on your screen exactly what routes players ran. So the game, as the game is being played, television is explicating it for the audience, which of course builds understanding and enhances, I think, the experience of the game. So for all those reasons, you know, television is just an ideal vehicle for the game of football.
We're speaking with Mark Bowden about his book, The Best Game Ever. You tell us also that football is transforming itself ahead of 1958 in some very intriguing ways. And perhaps most dramatically, and I think we've touched on this already briefly, is in the way that the game was coached. and that some of the young assistant coaches on the field, like Tom Landry and Vince Lombardi, were harbingers of what was going to be ultimately a much more sophisticated approach to the game and to the whole matter of strategy and handling of players and so on. And your book ties many of those innovations back to the great coach Paul Brown. Mm-hmm. Tell us what was the really essential shift which occurred with the emergence of Coach Brown and those who we might call his disciples.
Well, football had always been a kind of a roughneck sport, and it stemmed from its roots, in rugby, was primarily a running game where powerful men basically struggled in if it was an evenly matched game, it looked almost like a wrestling match in the middle of the field. But basically, you move the ball forward by running it. Football had always been afraid of the forward pass because it was such an effective offensive tool. At first, it was thought that it would break open the game so much that it'd be impossible to stop teams from scoring.
But you tell us in the book that rules were created to blunt the effectiveness of the forward pass for many years.
That's right. If you remember, we've all seen old newsreel footage of football games from the 1930s and 40s, and in some of those films, you see that the lines on the football field don't just run horizontally; they also run vertically. There's a checkerboard pattern, and the reason for that is that quarterbacks were obliged to throw the ball 5 yards either to the left or to the right. They weren't allowed to throw straight ahead because that was thought to be virtually unstoppable. So a pass had to travel at least 5 yards to the left or the right of the quarterback before it could be caught. And so those vertical lines on the field were to help referees determine whether a pass was legal or not. And in the old days, too, one of the rules was if a pass was incomplete, the other team got the ball. It wasn't just an incomplete pass. So all these rules were in place to discourage teams from passing too much. And one by one, they fell until by the 1950s, you had, for the first time, pro offenses like Paul Brown's fully integrating the passing game into the offensive attack. And this, of course, created tremendous challenges for defenders. And Tom Landry, as I describe in the book, the assistant coach for the New York Giants, actually created the standard pro defense today, the 4-3 defense, which is a desperation move to enable defenses to cover both against the pass and the run at the same time.
You also mention in your book the fact that the era just ahead of 1958 had been the era of players who played both ways, that is, both on offense and defense, but that this was, of course, going to dramatically change and was already changing in 1958. This was becoming an era in which players would be seen much more as specialists in a single position, and the great two-way players like Chuck Bednarik of the Philadelphia Eagles were a dying breed. Explain to our listeners why this specialization was so significant. I mean, the way in which it changed the game of football itself.
Well, it was one of the major steps to create the modern game. And prior to the adoption of free substitution, as it was called, players were obligated to play the whole game. And you could only substitute for them periodically, so they had to play both offense and defense. Well, that meant that certain specialist players, like, say, today's big 300-pound blockers, these guys are perfectly suited to defending a passer against a pass rush. But if they had to turn around and become pass rushers themselves, they couldn't move nearly as quickly. They weren't as agile or as fast as they would need to be to play on defense. And likewise, you have pass catchers who are extremely, nowadays, tall, slender men who are very fast, who are extremely good at catching passes. But if you turn them around and made them defend, against wide receivers, and it made them become tacklers. None of them, or very few of them, could perform at that level. So as soon as the league allowed free substitution, it enabled specialist athletes at every position, which vastly increased the quality of the football game, but also I think really began to make it a far more of a specialist sport.
Much of your book focuses on some of the key players in this 1958 championship game. We learn a lot about where they came from, what drew them to the game of football, and the way in which they were maybe the vanguard of a new kind of player. And, of course, one of the most fascinating figures of them all is the great wide receiver Raymond Berry. In many respects, maybe the player you spend the most time with in the pages of this book. There are all kinds of things that draw us to him, and maybe chief among them is how unlikely an NFL star he was. I mean, just to look at him, the last thing we would think is that this is an NFL football player. We would probably think he was a librarian, with all due respect to librarians who perhaps play football.
Yeah. You know, it's true. And I had, of course, heard of Raymond Berry, and I knew he was a great receiver. I knew very little about him personally when I started working on the book. But if you study the game itself, what you realize is that the Colts' victory ultimately came down to a series of plays late in the fourth quarter of that game, three plays in particular, all of which, when you begin to examine what happened, turned on Raymond Berry. So that's what started me researching Raymond, trying to figure out who this guy was and how he was able to do what he did in this football game. And the more I learned about Raymond, the more fascinated I was by him. And the more I realized that his approach to football, which was a sort of obsessive cerebral approach with a great deal of individual film study and preparation, where he basically took his position of wide receiver, made a study of it, and effectively reinvented it.
Hmm.
It reveals a lot about both him as a character, but also the sort of changing nature of pro football players.
I think one of the most intriguing things, and actually, as you just described him, I didn't even fully appreciate the irony of this, is because you've described him, as others have, of course, as an incredibly cerebral person. I mean, incredibly intelligent and meticulous and well-read and so on. I mean, not just sort of the single-minded football brute that someone might kind of imagine from this era. And yet, you call Raymond Berry, in a sense, one of the only complete full-time football players of this era. I mean, at a time when football players often had other jobs on the side and so on, and did not attack the game of football with this all-encompassing focus, that's what Raymond Berry did. I mean, in a sense, he was nothing but a football player.
That's right. Raymond did briefly hold part-time jobs, or tried them in the off-season, but ultimately gave them up because his passion was football. And he spent it was a full-time job for him all day, every day. Nowadays, of course, that's true of every professional football player. And, you know, Raymond was considered very odd in the 1950s, because even in the off seasons he worked out like crazy. He studied film. He spent all of his time off the field preparing for those moments when he would be on the field. Nowadays, that's how all professional football players are, in part because obviously they're paid well enough that they don't have to have any job outside of football, but also the game itself demands that of them. And I think the kind of film study that Raymond did on his own is today routine for pro football, except that there are probably five times as many assistant coaches, so that every player on the team has his own position coach, in some cases his own personal coach, to help him prepare and analyze, and get ready for every game. Raymond did all this on his own.
Hmm. He was fortunate to be a part of pro football at all. In fact, your book makes it sound like it's still kind of a mystery as in terms of just what in the world attracted the attention of any NFL team at all to this person who had achieved some success in college football, but nothing like that of other more famous wide receivers.
Yeah, and it goes back, to what I was saying a few minutes ago. We were talking about how the passing game had been fairly restricted in football. Raymond was a guy who caught passes. And in high school and college, he excelled at doing that, but he didn't get many chances to do it because teams, particularly at the high school and college level, were not throwing the ball all that often. Even Raymond, when he was selected by the Baltimore Colts in their what they called the futures draft, which was a very low round in the draft where they picked players who were thought to potentially have the ability to play pro football, he doesn't know how he even came to the attention of the Baltimore Colts, even to this day. He has some theories, but he got picked. And really the fact that he got picked is what inspired him to keep on playing. He was at the end of his junior year in college. He was he'd never even been a starter on the SMU football team. And so he had finished his academic work and was planning to leave and go back and teach in Texas where he was from. When the Colts picked him, it made him realize that there was a chance that he could make a living playing football. So he ended up staying on and playing in his senior year at SMU, where he continued to get better.
Hmm. Although he was not an imposing physical specimen, I mean, just to look at the guy, you would not, especially as a collegiate athlete, you never would have probably even guessed he was a member of the football team.
Right.
But you do talk about how, in ways that were quite innovative for the time, Raymond Berry worked not only on studying every facet of the position of wide receiver and the game of pro football, but also worked tirelessly to reshape himself physically. And he also had to do a lot of this completely on his own.
Totally on his own. And at the time, you know, the knowledge about sort of human mechanics and you know, how to exercise, how to get yourself in shape was very primitive, and some of the ideas were quite eccentric. Football players in the off season, for instance, were discouraged from lifting weights, from running, from doing the routine things that players do today to get themselves ready to play. Raymond was smart enough to not just to ignore the prohibitions, but also to devise his own techniques, some of which were really quite unusual. For instance, my favorite was how he would map out every move made by a wide receiver over the course of a football game using a stopwatch and taking notes. And then he would lay his crib sheet out on the grass at an empty stadium and play an entire football game in pantomime, running every route, trotting back, standing there, catching his breath in the huddle, going back out, running another play. He would do this to get himself in shape to play football. It was just one of many innovative training techniques that Raymond employed to get himself ready to play.
We should also mention that because he had his share of personality quirks, many of his teammates, especially in the early going, regarded him as kind of the resident nut of the team. I mean, quite bewildered. Of course, once he was able to do some great things, they had a bit more affection and admiration for the strange man in their midst. Yep. He probably would not have gone on to achieve what he did had not another player come aboard the Baltimore Colts who, in a sense, became his indispensable partner, and that, of course, would be quarterback Johnny Unitas. In some ways, they were a bit of an odd couple. I mean, he was not in any way, shape, and form out of the same mold as Raymond Berry, except a similar love for football and devotion to it. And they were quite the team. Tell us what happened between the two of them that made that such an important match.
Well, the two were united in their desperation, basically. And, of course, as with everything else in life, timing is everything. John Unitas had been an exceptional quarterback and athlete in high school and college, but he played for a team at Louisville that didn't do very well. And even though he was drafted by the Pittsburgh Steelers, they cut him without really giving him much of a chance to play. So he was playing sandlot football in Pittsburgh when the Baltimore Colts invited him to training camp to give him a last chance, really, to latch on to a job in pro football. And he arrived at the same moment that Raymond was returning after a very lackluster freshman year as a pro football player. And Raymond knew that his only chance of getting better and of making the team was to be able to work intensively with a quarterback to develop the kind of timing that would enable him to exploit these sort of sophisticated routes that he had learned to run. And Unitas was desperate for an opportunity to show what he could do. So when Raymond asked him if he would stay after practice and work with him and throw with him, Unitas quickly agreed because his whole goal was to let those coaches see how well he could throw the ball and how accurate he was. And so the two of them began this partnership in that year at training camp where they worked excessively. And then Raymond pulled John into film study, which is something that John probably would not have done as much on his own. So they complemented each other perfectly. Raymond's cerebral approach to the game, I think, elevated Unitas. And, of course, Unitas' natural ability, which was much in evidence in this 1958 game, his sort of natural strategic instincts, both enabled Raymond to become the greatest receiver in the NFL, but also took the Colts to the heights.
Hmm. You call the heart and soul of Johnny Unitas' story the discarded gem rediscovered almost by accident. And you also remind us that Johnny Unitas didn't look good, he didn't sound good, he just was good. On the side of the New York Giants, you, of course, tell us a lot about some of their most important players. And you probably spend the most time talking about their extraordinary linebacker, a man named Sam Huff. Tell us what you find most gratifying about his story.
Well, of course, Sam Huff is a central player in this story, again, because the critical moment in the critical moments of this game, it came down to a battle of wits between, you know, John Unitas and Sam Huff and Raymond Berry, to a certain extent, and Tom Landry. And so Huff is, I think, the pivotal player for this particular game. He was also, I think, the key to the great Giants defense, which made that team so terrific in the 50s and 60s. Huff was a guy who was, again, like Raymond Berry, a transitional player in pro football in that he had played on the offensive line all through college. And yet when he got to the pros, as good an athlete as he was a little too small to compete effectively on the line. So he had made the team, but he was really hanging on by his fingernails when Tom Landry, the defensive coach, began noticing that he had the perfect physical proportions and athletic ability to play this new position he had created called middle linebacker, which was a guy who was big enough to be a lineman in a pinch, but also fast enough and athletic enough to drop back into pass coverage. And so he recruited Huff to basically help him create this 4-3 defense, which was new at the time. And, you know, it was Huff's partnership with Landry that both, you know, made Huff a great football player and Landry a great coach, but also that made, I think, that Giants defense as good as it was.
Hmm. Your book, of course, explores the on-field exploits of other participants in this game, including the great Giants running back Frank Gifford. We learned something of the place kicker Pat Summerall, some of the big figures on defense, including Gio Marchetti and Rosie Greer, and an intriguing cast of characters they are. You also not only spend some time with various coaches, but you also tell us the story of a young man, a teenager, actually, at the time, who was on the sidelines with camera in hand. Tell our listeners about this teenager and why he is worth following on this dramatic day as well.
Well, his name is Neil Leifer, and he was 16 years old on the day that this game was played. He had a borrowed camera from a community center in New York. He was just learning how to develop his own film and had developed an interest in photography. He didn't have a press pass, and he didn't have the money to buy a ticket, but he got into the Yankee Stadium by agreeing to wheel veterans in wheelchairs into the end zone, which is where the New York Giants put disabled fans and let them watch the game. And so by helping out before the game, the cops let Neil Leifer stay on the sidelines, but he couldn't go any further than the back of the end zone where they kept the guys in the wheelchairs. So here was this kid with his twin-lens reflex borrowed camera who was not in the same position to roam the sidelines as the professional photographers, but who ended up being in exactly the right spot when Alan Ameche plunged into the end zone at the end of the game with the winning touchdown to snap a picture that has become, in part because of the relatively primitive nature of the camera he was using, became the sort of iconic photograph of this football game. And what makes it even more interesting is that, of course, Neil Leifer went on to become one of the most famous sports photographers in American history for Sports Illustrated. And there's a whole host of great sports photographs, like the one of Muhammad Ali standing over a felled Sonny Liston shouting down at him, "What's my name?" All these fantastic images from sports, which were created by Neil Leifer later in his career, began with this one serendipitous shot at what was, you know, considered to be the best football game ever.
And, of course, if he had had a fancier camera with all these zoom lenses, he would not have caught this incredible image of these darkened stands in the background and the full height of this stadium. I mean, it is as though we are on the floor of the Roman Colosseum, and it is partly because of that rather simple primitive camera that he had at his disposal that the image is as powerful as it is. Well, of course, our time is gone, and we haven't even really talked about the nuts and bolts of the game itself. We leave that to our listeners to take your book in hand. We should just touch briefly on two little things that are so amazing as this game is played out. First of all, that when it ends in a 17-17 tie at regulation play, you tell us many of the players left the field thinking the game was over, because at that point in time, sudden death overtime was something that never happened.
Right. You know, it was funny to me that the players had never done this before, and some of them hadn't even, you know, as Al Berry put it, who reads the program? They had no idea that there was a special rule set up for this game, so a lot of them were exhausted. They felt like they'd played their hearts out. They were beginning to calculate what their earnings would be for a tie, and suddenly the referee says, "We're going to kick off and keep on playing."
Yeah, many of them would have been very content to leave this game in a tie.
Yep.
You also tell us that at one point, inadvertently, the cable which made the live telecast was pulled apart or something, and this this telecast was rudely interrupted, and for some time. And in your book, we can read of the ploy of someone involved with the network running out on the field, pretending to create a diversion. In fact, creating a diversion which bought a bit of precious time until that cable could be reattached and the telecast resumed. This game had a little bit of everything: high drama and a bit of comedy as well.
Now 8:59, a minute before 9 o'clock, and that wraps up today's edition of the WGTD Morning Show. Quick reminder, support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, the Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Also, support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's is located at 2401 60th Street in Kenosha. Online, andreasgifts.com. Coming up at 9 o'clock, we join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming. Let's get you up to date on the weather forecast from the National Weather Service. For today, Friday the 22nd, cloudy, some scattered snow showers, maybe an inch of accumulation, high today at 30. We got some flurries now in the air at this hour. Tonight, cloudy, 40% chance of light snow, low at 20. It's now 24 in Racine, 23 Kenosha, 21 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, NPR News.